You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name's Elaine Kmark. I'm a senior fellow here at Governance Studies at Brookings. I am substituting today for our Vice President of Governance Studies, who's the expert in this area, Daryl West. Daryl went to Beijing and is trying to get back from Beijing. He was supposed to come back on Sunday. Not a great day for air travel in the District of Columbia. So let me fill in here as best I can with a very interesting and very distinguished panel. What I want to do is I'll introduce each of our panelists right now and then open the discussion with some questions to them and quickly get to audience questions, okay? So to my immediate right, we have someone representing the Congress. We have Brett Meeks. He serves as health. You have to take responsibility for the whole thing, okay? nobody wants to do that these days, right? Brett serves as health counsel on the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions for Chairman Lamar Alexander of Tennessee. His policy areas include Medicare, Medicaid, and health information technology. He has a wide range of experience in healthcare law and policy, including work in a small physician practice, a large research hospital, litigation, and a health policy consultancy. So welcome, Brett.
Thank you.
To his right, we have the Chief Information Officer for Optum, Mike Conley. He leads a team responsible for identifying trends, delivering disruptive technology, and increasing speed to market to make the healthcare system work better for everyone. Prior to his current role, Mike served as Chief Executive Officer for QSSI. And prior to that, he was Chief Technology Officer for United Health Group IT. We want to mention here, United Health Group provides generous support to Governance Studies, which makes possible the work that we do. And we're glad to have Mike with us today to share his personal experiences in this area. To his right is Alice Borelli, Global Director of Healthcare Policy for Intel Corporation, who works with the United States and with international policymakers on healthcare reform and health IT issues. During the healthcare reform debate, she focused on reforms that would include innovative technologies for care delivery, including e-care, remote patient monitoring, and telehealth. And then, last but certainly not least over there, we have Elise Sweeney Anthony. She is Acting Director of Policy at the ONC, the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology at HHS. Elise leads ONC's engagement on a wide range of high-priority federal policy efforts, including regulatory development, information blocking, MACRA implementation, and governance. Her portfolio also includes emerging issues and health IT policy matters impacting EHR incentive program participants and other care settings. Prior to this, Elise served as Deputy Director of Policy, where she led the Division of Strategic Policy. Welcome, Elise. So we've got just about everybody here covering every piece of this puzzle. And I have a particular interest in this panel because I want to know why I can't email my doctor, okay? Which I suspect many of you will, in fact, tell me why I can't. But I'm going to start in this order and just throw out a question and ask our panelists to start thinking about these issues for us. Brett, do you think the EHR incentive program is working well? And how is the general level of participation across the sector? Is it moving the needle on adoptions?
So anyone who has kept up with me or my boss can answer that no, we don't think it's working very well. We think stage one of meaningful use was very good at getting physicians and hospitals to adopt EHR systems and health IT in general. But stage two and stage three we see as very troublesome. When we have some of the best and most sophisticated hospital systems in the country coming to us and screaming that they are terrified of stage three before it was finalized, I think that's a serious problem. And I think whether or not, you know, I'm sure it was all very well intended, but the consequences and penalties that it levies on physicians and hospitals are very serious. So I think, you know, there's definitely been a role for government in getting folks to adopt health information technology, but we have to sort of gauge now as we move forward what that role is going to be, and whether or not we are going to continue to penalize people for not checking boxes that are arbitrary in their practice. And do these things really help us improve care, or is it just some regulation that, you know, isn't very well thought out? So, no, I don't think they're doing very well, and I think they need to be changed.
Can you, for those of us who are neophytes here, can you expand a little bit more on what happens in stage three and why people are so worried about it?
Sure. So one example that we speak about is in stage two, 5% of physicians were going to be required to allow their patients to view, download, and transmit is the name of the requirement. So that means your patient has to have access to a portal so they can see their healthcare record, they have to be able to download it, and then they send a message back to the doctor. So that seems very reasonable, right? 5%. The problem is it's making a physician liable for the actions of a patient. You can't really force the patient to go home and transmit a message to them if they don't want to. So you hear about doctors who are raffling off iPads to try to get their patients to just send a message when they get home. Some people I've heard, you know, in the room will actually send the message on behalf of the patient. So that 5% threshold in stage two is dropped down in the modifications to one patient. So obviously, I think the administration heard the complaints. The problem is in stage three, it goes up to 30% and 80% in some cases, and they change it a little bit, but it seems to be, as my boss put it, the administration seems to have a tin ear when it comes to this sort of thing, to where if everyone's complaining, why are we raising the bar on something that's not working right now?
I think I'm going to actually change and go straight to Elise here.
I'm not
given,
surprised.
Given that comment.
Shouldn't be surprised. Sorry.
And ask you if you would respond to that, Elise, and also, you know, talk more broadly about the investment the federal government has made in electronic health records and the challenges.
So I'll start by, one, saying that I obviously work for ONC. The EHR incentive programs is actually managed by CMS. There is a lot that we work a lot with them on from the beginning, from when high tech was passed and it was time to think about how do we go from a very low adoption rate for industries to moving into what ultimately became stage one. So ONC and CMS did work a lot on what the requirements would be in terms of the health information technology, and that's kind of where ONC comes in. ONC tries to think about what are the health information technology pieces that are integral, that are important for providers to be able to service their patients in the best way possible. Stage one, as was noted, focused very much on adoption. Stage two moved more towards advanced use of that technology. And then I believe that stage three was developed by CMS, was really to move towards outcomes. Recently, Dr. DeSalvo, who is the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology and Acting Administrator Slavitt, wrote a blog that talked about the transition underway for meaningful use and a kind of a sneak peek, as it were, in terms of thinking about how the administration is looking at meaningful use as we go forward. One of the main things that they talked about is outcomes, is moving towards outcomes and thinking about how meaningful use fits into the larger rubric of MACRA, which is the more recent legislation that was put together and passed. And now, as we think about the regulation to implement that, what does that mean and how does meaningful use fit into that? One of the categories in the merit-based incentive program, which is the new piece in MACRA, is on meaningful use. And I think part of what Acting Administrator Slavitt and Dr. DeSalvo are thinking about is how do those come together. In terms of kind of thinking about stage two, there were some modifications that I know CMS did do to stage two, and those were the stage two mods that were released in the fall of 2015. And that also included provisions for stage three. And CMS did include a piece on stage three that allowed for public comment on that final rule. So even though stage three went in and it was finalized, it allowed for public comment. And part of that was in recognition that as MACRA comes down the pike, how do we consider the path that we are on in terms of the path that MACRA sets forth and how to think about outcomes in that vein. To talk about some of the other challenges mm-hmm. that we're seeing, I don't know if I would necessarily say it's challenges as much as it's next steps. We have come, I think, a long way as a stakeholder community, from our federal stakeholders to those who are on the ground, to physicians, to hospitals, to critical access hospitals. I'm gonna try to reduce the number of acronyms. So if you say anything twice, that's why.
I told Elise that HHS was getting as bad as the military when it came to acronyms. And actually, while we're at it, can you define MACRA?
Sure. Okay. So MACRA is, I'll describe it more in terms of what it is.
Okay.
Which I think is helpful. So MACRA is legislation that was passed by Congress. And the purpose of it, as far as, from our perspective, was to think about how a number of reporting programs could be brought together under one umbrella and think about alignment across things like quality reporting, resource use, meaningful use, and then general clinical practice improvement. And that's under the rubric of the merit-based incentive program, MIPS. There's another piece of MACRA that is really important. There's a number of other provisions, which we could spend all day talking about MACRA, which is not really what we're here for. But there's another piece of MACRA that's really important as well, and that's the transition to APM. So there's a fair amount of provisions in MACRA that focus on APMs, which are advanced payment models. So thinking about moving towards value-based payment and how to incentivize that. And then the part that we at ONC are thinking about is how to support health information technology that could benefit providers who are moving towards that APM world, that value-based payment world. So there's also limits to what I can talk about on that, because obviously this is something that is now before the administration to develop regulations on. So, but to go a little bit back to the two challenges, or what I would call next steps in terms of where we are, for ONC, we're thinking a lot about the transition in terms of there's been a fair amount of adoption when we think about certain settings. And I'm careful to say that because there is a recognition at ONC that not all settings are covered by the EHR incentive programs or some of the settings that are touched by our program. So while eligible professionals or, many practices or hospitals or critical access hospitals are covered by the EHR incentive program, that's not the only place that ONC is thinking about. We're thinking about how to better support other settings. So that's long-term post-acute care, skilled nursing facilities, behavioral health settings, pediatric settings. There's a number of different areas where we've heard from our stakeholders that health information technology is needed. And not only is health information technology needed, but certified health information technology is needed. And the benefit of that, from our perspective, is that there is an assurance to what we provide. So our certification program enables a provider and developers to know what the expectations are, what the needs are of practices, and what we as the administration believe is necessary. So what does that mean? So it means that we focus on interoperability, and that's one of the, what you would say, challenges. I would say next step is moving towards mm-hmm. interoperability. So interoperability is about having, in some parts, standards-based health information technology. So we talk in our 2015 rule, which was released in the fall, about a common set of data. So we used to call it the common MU data set. Now it's the common clinical data set because we're thinking about beyond MU, obviously. But that common clinical data set is a key set of information that we think should move when the patient moves, to the extent it's relevant and important to the patient, right? So that information being able to move, and for providers to be able to know that their product that is certified by ONC is able to do that effectively and in the way that is required is really important. And in addition to that, we attach things like privacy and security. What are the privacy and security pieces that should attach to information when it moves from one provider to another? And then we also think about things in terms of this, in terms of how the standards support that data set. So when that data set is wrapped up and sent, and I'm using vernacular here to, I'm going to try to move away from the technology a little bit and talk about the concepts, right? So the concept is when that provider wraps up that data in the electronic folder, right? In the electronic folder, and pretty much moves it over to the next provider during a transitions of care. Can that next provider open it, use it effectively? And that's part of what we're thinking about in terms of how information moves. I'll stop there, but there's more I can talk about, but I think I've been talking too long.
We'll come back. Don't worry about it. I think I'd like to go to Mike now, because you brought up, Elise, the concept of continuity of care, and I know that, Mike, you've been working on this question of continuous improvement. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
About continuous improvement and how it improves it? Well, I think I'd answer that in a couple ways, just, you know, speaking, you know, frankly, from our experience, which is what I know best. One of the things that's really important is to continue to measure the value of what we're doing, and especially those things that are enabled by connectivity, since they're pretty substantial investments. An example of that is we have a business called House Calls. House Calls basically does what it says. It has nurse practitioners who provide care and in someone's home. And what has really made a big difference for the effectiveness of that program is the technology enablement to have a very clear closed-loop process for communication back to the providers and to the nurse practitioner who's working in the field. Now, when I say it's important to measure, an independent study was done on that and found that that technology-enabled intervention at a convenient place for the consumer at their home led to a 9% reduction in hospital admissions and a 28% reduction in readmissions. And as you might imagine, I don't know, if I asked you to raise your hand if you'd like to go and be admitted to the hospital, I don't think there'd get many hands. If there were, we should really talk to you afterwards. But if one out of four folks who undergo this intervention and this style of intervention, this technology-enabled intervention, doesn't go back into the hospital, that's a pretty powerful argument that you have something that works and that the investment and the work has been validated. And then to that, I'll add the importance of continuing to do innovation. We spend a great deal of efforts, sometimes somewhat speculatively, building capabilities in order to help any one of a number of constituents in the system. And one of them that we do is called Link. It's aimed at providers. And it's really designed to create a secure channel to work with providers, to give them access to other resources, to be API enabled, to even have an ability to download health-related applications. And that kind of innovation and measuring and finding out what's working, I think, is going to be continue as we drive improvement over time.
Mm-hmm. Great. Alice, let's go to a slightly different topic but related. What kind of progress is being made in migrating away from fee-for-service models towards more integrated care models? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, thank you. And I work for Intel, and you may think it odd that Intel would be on a healthcare panel, but we've been in the healthcare business in many ways for the past 20 plus years. And we provide, of course, the servers in the hospital. We provide the chips and the PCs and tablets that physicians are using today. And during this course of typical health IT, we've done a lot of research with our ethnographers. And in fact, as the story goes, we've lived in about 1,000 homes with Alzheimer's patients to find out how technology can be better used in the home, as you mentioned, and really sort of moving forward with different products that are in development or are in the market today. We've done, and the second part that we've really been involved with is genomics research, and that has been a growth area for the company. As the sequencing becomes faster, that's what we're optimizing. We actually have a phrase at Intel, all in a day. We want to get to the point by 2020, or maybe it'll be 2025, but the goal is out there, to have a patient's genome sequenced, analyzed through high-powered data analytics, and the treatment options be available in a day. And now it's taking months and sometimes years. So that's the goal, and that sort of gives you an overview of where Intel is in the healthcare space. So in terms of ACOs, I'd like to talk about this in two ways. One, Where are the rules and regulations that are moving ACOs forward and then holding them back? And two, talk about the Intel ACO that we now have in four different states, and 31,000 employees are on. And this month, we have processed 40,000 records on an interoperable basis for our employees. So let's first go to where we stand in terms of the ACOs in macro, the Medicare and CHIP. Thank you. Medicare. I was going to try to give you the worst, but forget it. You explained it perfectly. So the new way that physicians are paid. So we have the two divisions where they'll be paid by through alternative payment models, and then we have sort of a fee-for-service-like but better coordinated system. So on the APM side, this is more like ACOs, and you have bundled care and other new ways of payment that really looks at risk, and it puts the provider at either a one-sided or two-sided risk a payment system. So it's really, and if you think about maybe a per patient per month kind of system that you have for Medicare Advantage, it's similar but not exactly the same. So the idea is to provide a high level of care at a lower cost point. And we have been really watching this carefully because of the barriers to bringing telehealth and remote patient monitoring into these models. We have heard many times from HHS that, well, you have this incentive, so you don't need to be paid for that anymore. Hospitals will just do this because it's in their best interest, and some hospitals are. And some hospitals are doing this to reduce readmissions. But you also need sort of a ramp up, a bridge for those hospitals, and enough of an incentive, which is beyond the one-sided risk, which is, you know, you just get a minor bonus for reducing costs. And two-sided risk really starts to kick in, where you're looking for more economical ways of delivering care at home, on the go, where the patient needs that care. But we think that because there's so little knowledge of this in the Medicare community, that you need a ramp up for that. And there's some legislation being considered in the Senate called the Bridge that would give providers fee-for-service payments over the next 2 years so that they could experiment, get used to this, invest in some equipment, as well as really it's the know-how and what patients really qualify for remote patient monitoring and would work, when do you need to use telehealth, and when does it not work? And so, you know, we'll look forward to that legislation being introduced next week. But there are some barriers, and I will go back to the fact that in ACO, there was a remote patient monitoring and telehealth provision, but it's really never been fleshed out because there's no payment, and we know providers and doctors and the rest of us in our jobs, we don't do what we don't get paid for, right? So we really need a ramp up to this. So that's sort of, you know, what we're looking forward to over the next few months and a discussion in Congress about that. Now, secondly, I wanted to just talk with you a little bit about our experience at Intel. We decided to change the way we were doing healthcare benefits. And instead of trying to keep good health care for employees at lower cost, we changed this whole picture and said, we want our employees to be healthy, and that's our goal. So we started looking at how to do that, and we decided to offer our own accountable care organization as one of the options for your benefit coverage. We started this in New Mexico with about 6,000 employees, then went to Oregon with 17,000. And then we've just introduced it in Arizona, where I think we have about 5,000 employees. That just launched January 1st. We negotiated with the hospitals. We did an RFP process. Those that wanted to adhere to our own quality measures, an additional quality to everything else they had. And the other provision is you had to have interoperable electronic health records. So in New Mexico, we didn't quite get it right, and so we didn't make that second goal of interoperable health records. But we learned something. So when we moved to Oregon, where we had over 17,000 employees, And we had two major hospitals and clinics where we wanted all of this, all of our records to be accessible at the point of care. So when an employee went to an on-site clinic with Intel and a community clinic or hospital, they would have point of care access to that record. And it took a while. We wanted a query system, you know, a point-to-point system. It wouldn't really work for what we wanted. And we had that in the contract with the hospitals. Within 7 months, we were able to do this for the first time in the Portland, Oregon area for all of our employees who signed up for this program. Then we moved to Arizona. In Arizona, it's a very complex healthcare system. There were 150 electronic healthcare records companies that had to be integrated. So the lessons learned from our other experience, we chose the Sequoia Project, who used to be called Healthy Way, to be the integrated health information exchange. They have a certain set of standards that all of the providers using this myriad of EHRs had to subscribe to. Some dropped off. You know, I'm not sure how many we ended up with, actually. But this month, we went live with all of our record, all of our employees having point of care access. So my point to this is where there's a will, there's a way. We had the will. Our vendors, the hospital and the electronic health records companies who supported those hospitals, had the will because of that relationship. And working together, which we really did, we put our engineers in the same teams with the hospitals and the vendors, it happened. And so I'd just like to say that the possible is there. I should quit now, right?
But I have one more.
We really respect all of the work that ONC has done to get us ready to this point. It has made such a difference. The kinds of reforms that both the House and Senate and the bill that Brett just has worked on are trying to move the rest of the country this way, because it's really, it's a miracle when it happens. And even the doctors love it. I mean, our employees sometimes have said, oh, well, we're Intel. We expect that kind of, you know, access. But the doctors are going, oh, yeah, this is pretty cool. So, you know, it can be done, I think, today, but we may need these additional pushes from legislation, and we just really appreciate the kind of attention that Congress has put on this.
Brett, did you want to have a last word on that before we go to the audience?
Sure. I got to plug myself, right?
No.
Everything Alice was just talking about, I mean, Intel is doing such great work. They're really setting the standard for what we should be doing. Maybe the Senate will follow suit and I'll have access to my records too. There are a lot of, you know, problems, and there's just a lot of opportunity out there in health IT. And we saw last year with 21st Century Cures in the House, they had an interoperability section. The Senate Health Committee, where I work, we had six hearings last year on trying to get records exchanging, how we get this to work, right? Because everyone wants it to happen, but for some reason it's not happening. So we introduced a bipartisan staff discussion draft last Wednesday. We're actually asking for comments by this Friday, so if you haven't seen it yet, get
this
on
crowd
it.
This crowd may, in fact, have some comments.
But we would love feedback. This stuff is very complicated. I don't know that I'm capable of getting it right the first try, so we need to hear what we're doing wrong, where we missed it, what we need to change, and we need feedback from folks like you, because we're scheduled to mark up February 9th, which is pretty soon.
All right, well, let's hear from this group, because having gone through the organizations represented here, this is actually a pretty weighty group. So why don't we start up here, and we'll kind of go down and around. We have some time. Yes.
Luke Agliano, I'm a healthcare consultant, and I practice both on the instrument side and now on the policy side. So philosophically, I think what I'm struck with is the issue of incentives versus, in essence, penalties. And I think the reason that's important is the following issue. We have a fractionated payer system in the United States, and the payers really have a stake in this game, which is to send their patients in their covered lives to the place where the best care is given. And we need to figure out some way to connect the quality measures of what is going to happen based on some of these programs, whether it's macro two or phase three, both from the physician side and the hospital side, so that payers can begin to think about how to migrate patients to where the best care is given. And we have to recognize in that there's a philosophy here of maybe saying, well, we're taking the patient out of it. But frankly, the patient in a lot of cases cannot make good decisions. Comments?
Yeah. Mike, do you want to lead off?
It's a bit out of my area of expertise, but I think it's just it's interesting when you struck that the patient can't always make the best decisions. Because one of the things, in addition to thinking about how we get the system to work together, and the phrase I like to think of is not in terms of penalties or in terms of rewards, but how you make doing the right thing the path of least resistance. So it's just easier to do what needs to be done in a way that's consistent with the broader values or the broader goals than what was there. One thing we need to remember that's really critical is that maybe the most powerful stakeholder of all is, in fact, the consumer. And you had asked a question about email, and it made me think a little bit about the fact that, you know, we have all the direct interaction with the payer community, provider community, et cetera. But then we also have a set of consumers who have their own values, who very much value privacy, very much value security, but also very much value convenience, right? And we're in a situation where we're trying to find that right balance between them and really need to continue to innovate to improve that.
So I was just going to comment a little bit on the from ONC's side of it. I mentioned before the 2015 edition final rule that we released fall of 2015. And that's pretty much our rule of the list, as it were, if someone hear me say, a buffet. We provide a buffet, if you think about it, of certified health IT. So it could be things related to your ability to do computerized provider order entry, to do clinical decision support, to do patient capture of information. And a developer can look at our list and say, these are the things that I need to support the provider population I work with. And then the provider also can look at our list and say, developer, these are the things that I need from your system to be able to do. So as part of our list, we do think about that. We think about things from not only the perspective of the provider, but also the perspective of the patient. We actually have an entire team at ONC that works on consumer e-health. From the rule perspective, we even included in the 2015 edition a couple of things that we think focus on the larger patient perspective. So one, being able to capture patient information. So we said that's one of the things you need to be able to do. And CMS echoed that in their rule as well through their certified EHR definition, technology definition. But being able to capture patient information and also being able to provide the patient with information as a provider in the way that works for them. So that's whether it's encrypted or not, for example. Another thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to think about what information helps the patient the best. So that's things like not just clinical data, but we wanted to provide an option in our buffet, as you have it, of being able to think about social determinants, what some would call social determinants of health. We call it social, psychological, and behavioral data. So are you depressed, educational status, things of that nature that provide a fuller picture of what the patient looks like. And that, to us, goes to things like continuity of care. But it also goes to how that information is able to move. So does it just sit siloed in the system, or is it able to move from the primary care provider to the dermatologist and then back to the primary mm-hmm. care provider? Mm-hmm. So that type of information is also what we're taking in. So trying to take in more information about the patient that can help, but also being able to take in patient information. The last thing I want to mention is APIs. So we included this in our 2015 edition rule as well. Sometimes we have standards attached to what we put in a rule. Sometimes it's about functionality. And that's because in this case, in APIs, we took this to our federal advisory committees. There's two federal advisory committees that we work with, and we said, tell us about APIs. Give us some insight on where we are in APIs. We're actually doing the second phase of that now on some of the privacy and security questions that have come up about APIs. But at the time when we were developing the 2015 edition, APIs were is something that you see in many different sectors, but not as much in the health space. And we wanted to provide an opportunity for innovation to occur, recognizing that it's all not settled now, and there's a huge place for the private sector to help think about what that looks like. What are the standards that attach? So there's a functionality requirement in our 2015 edition rule that supports APIs. And why is that important? Because that's one of the ways that patients are able to communicate with their provider. And it's also one of the ways that you can envision, right? So in my wonderful blue sky world, in my brain, you can envision a world where a patient is able to look through an API and see the information from their dermatologist, see the information from their primary care provider when they were admitted to the hospital, and all of that information is in one localized place. Are we necessarily there yet? Not necessarily, but part of what we want to do as ONC is we want to support some of that work that's happening in the private sector, as you talked about. So it's a comment.
Did you want to add something there, Brick?
That's
okay.
Good.
Let's see, right here.
Thank you very much. John Graham from the National Center for Policy Analysis. And my question, I just had lunch with someone from Denmark, so my question is about international lessons can we learn. I mean, Intel obviously is a global company, and United Health Group has got international operations. And whenever I talk to someone, especially from Europe, or they seem to be more connected in the healthcare space. So I wonder, on the staff side, are you folks considering international examples, or even at ONC, you know, FDA has a lot of, you know, international connections, but from ONC, I don't get a lot of signal that you're learning from what other countries have done. So, but I'm sure this panel would have some great comments on that. So thank you.
So I'll just mention briefly, there's, I think, a lot of work where we try to pull from a number of different kind of lessons learned and best practices, whether they're international or whether they're localized in terms of within the U.S. There's work with the U.K. where we work with them and collaborate as well. But I think it's an ongoing conversation. It's one of those areas where we'd like to see what's happening and how some of that might be supported by our rule. Sometimes things are moving along pretty well, or sometimes we get to a point where a lot of progress has been made and we want to focus more on the next phase of that effort. So, for example, I talked about stage one. Stage one was really about adoption. Can you do this? Do you have a system that can do this? As Dr. DeSalvo talks about, we are now moving to the next step, which is does your health information technology support the outcomes you want to achieve? Which is a different conversation. So you have the technology, but now can you use it to get to the outcomes for the patients that you want to see? So wherever we can pull from to incorporate some of those, that information lessons learned is where we would.
If I could just add that, you know, being an international company, sometimes we have the opportunity to work with different policymakers and bring those ideas. And in fact, Steve Posniak has agreed from ONC to meet with Denmark and Norway on what they're doing on telehealth and remote patient monitoring, because they've actually deemed the Continua Health Alliance standards as the standards for how they're going to issue RFPs, because these are standards for personal health, which we've been talking about, with that the patient supplies the data, but it's all interoperable. It's plug and play. And when you go through the certification and testing process, you come out at the end with the certification that means your systems are interoperable. So I could have a Philips weight scale along with a Roche insulin tester, and all of that would be connected to an Intel platform, and it would all work. And that's what we're looking for. So Denmark has done an excellent job, as well as Norway, in that area. And I think ONC has been really open to talking with these folks.
Let's see, gentleman in the blue shirt over there, and then we'll come back up here.
Thanks. For those of us who work in the healthcare IT sector, interoperability has been the name of the game for quite some time now. But I think, you know, we always hear about how it's still lagging, especially, you know, as it was just mentioned, compared to Denmark, for instance. What do you think could be done on the parts of, you know, I think there's a lot of pieces. There's vendors and hospitals and also government. where do you think each of those, what role do each of those play? And also, if you could also loop in something about the new fire regulatory standard.
You want to start with that one?
I'm not familiar with the new fire regulatory standard. Sorry, but the rest of your question, I can say that, you know, if you take a look at the interoperability roadmap, it's clearly good work, and it's clearly the right path. It also is clear that it's going to take a lot of stakeholders to make that work. That is going to take the private sector, it's going to take the public sector, it's going to take a considerable amount of work to get that together, or to get that roadmap moving and to get it prioritized. And just a couple thoughts from our perspective in terms of that roadmap is some very important things that, you know, we might see priorities that is to build that coalition of private and public to make it work, and also address the issue of the of data matching, in particular, how, you know, the data matching, how you know a record is tied to a particular person. I know there's a lot of discussion about that as to whether you do that with an ID or whether you do that otherwise. And then finally, the issue of data blocking, or we might call it data hoarding, in terms of making sure that there are the right incentives so that data is freely expressed for the benefit of ultimately of the patient, not just for the benefit of the organizations.
So I can add to that. I feel like I'm talking too much, so I'll try to keep this one brief. Thank you for mentioning the interoperability roadmap. I think that's obviously a key piece of the work we're doing. We also have the Federal Health IT Strategic Plan. That's another piece of our puzzle. But all of these come together to the goal of trying to get to, I think, outcomes in a lot of ways. So the interoperability roadmap, you're right. It is not just a government tool. It's not just a government action. From the time that we released it, even in the draft form, it was really about a coordination and commitments from the private sector, as well as our work that we're going to do from the public sector, as it were. So there's a number of things that we've been working on continuously on that. One is just to mention this on the state side, right? States are another key player in this. Medicaid, for example, if you think about EHR incentive programs, not to really speak for CMS, but that's a big piece of, obviously, MU. So we just released a state compendium that's on our website, healthit.gov. That's our little plug. And if you check it out, it's a great resource. It's a great resource because it, and this is one of the projects of our Office of Care Transformation and Kelly Cronin. And what it does is it provides a list, a searchable list of activities states are doing in different activities, whether it's risk management, whether it's interoperability, all of these different things. You can actually do a drop-down list and you can see how states are implementing these very innovative programs. And that's a way of us bringing best practices up and dropping it back down so it's a resource for folks to think about interoperability, for example. That's one thing. The other thing I want to note is information blocking, which I'm sure is going to come up with today. So we released a report some time ago now, but it seems like just yesterday, an information blocking report, and this is something that Congress asked us to do. And we put it together, and it talks about what information blocking is from our perspective. And one of the things we note in it is information blocking can happen from a number of different actors. It's not necessarily developers. It's not necessarily providers. It could be a number of different stakeholders who are involved in that. What we're doing now is we're thinking about how can we help to provide more information across the landscape in terms of products so that everybody's more informed about what their products can do, what the restrictions are on the product. So in our 2015 edition rule, we included a whole section that updated the transparency requirements. So things like when a developer is coming to us for certification, what type of information are you making available to providers about the product? Are you talking about the types of costs? And then if I'm a provider, how do I find that information? Where do I go for it? So we included a provision that requires it to be available at a particular website or web address, and you have to provide that to us. And then we're doing our part in terms of transparency and moving the conversation because we have what we affectionately call the CHAPL, which is a certified health IT products list. And all developer products that are certified are included on there. And we're increasing the type of information that's available on that on that list, and it's available online, but things like transparency and what are the disclosures that a provider is making, that a developer is making available about a particular project. So that goes to increasing the information that's available across the landscape so that things like information blocking, for example, are discussion points between the provider and the developer in terms of what the product can do, what types of costs might be associated with that type of action. So in terms of transparency, we're trying to get there through that avenue as well. And then one other thing, I'm sorry, I want to know.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. Is we're also working with our federal partners. So OIG, Office of Inspector General at HHS, they recently released a policy reminder, as it were. It's not so much alert because it's not new information, but the Stark and anti-kickback provisions allow for a product or software to be shared with another provider, for example. And there are usually certain restrictions associated with that. But one of the things that, while that exception allows for that software to move, let's say I'm a hospital and I am giving technology or software to a practice I work with, usually there are restrictions on that. What the exception allows is for that to happen. But one of the things that OIG has said is that if you're doing that, be mindful that there are certain requirements attached to whether you are blocking when you're doing that. So if you're giving that technology under the exception to a practice as a hospital, are you putting restrictions that affect or involve information blocking? And be mindful of that as you do that, because we want to make sure that that's not happening. So there's different ways that we're looking at information blocking to try to address it from a number of different avenues.
Good. Let's see, right here, and then we'll go to you, ma'am. Right here.
Right here?
Yeah.
Thanks. Actually, that segues well into the questions I have. I want to talk about two specific subjects. One is unique device identifiers, and the second is cybersecurity of medical devices. So the first one, there's been, you know, lawmakers have asked CMS to require UDIs on claims forms, and also ONC FDA has been very supportive of this, but there's been some pushback from hospitals and even and CMS to a certain degree, that the cost benefit is just not there. And secondly, that because there's three different agencies who certify these UDIs, and there's also the issue of not being automated, that it might actually put patients more at risk. So the question I have about UDIs is, what needs to happen in order for UDIs to be more widely adopted? Does there need to be a financial incentive? Does there need to be more legislation? And the second question is about cybersecurity. As some of you might know, last week FDA had a cybersecurity workshop. On the one hand, the market analysts I've talked to have said, you know, this might be a bit late in the game for FDA to require vulnerability testing, to require certain standards possibly develop that, because they're really worried that 2016 will be the year where a device will be hacked into and somebody will be injured because of that. But on the other hand, you've got industry who say that, you know, this is maybe a little overblown. I was wondering, as experts, what are your thoughts on that? What side is more accurate in this? And secondly, what do we do about making sure that these devices are secure?
Brett, is this something you guys have encountered?
Sure. Unique device identifiers came as part of a, you know, requirement that passed a few years ago. FDA has many authorities, and we haven't seen a system put in place to track them in post-market, and there's a lot of talk about that right now. ONC in their 2015 edition certification rule actually requires UDIs to be part of electronic health records. They require a lot of things in that rule, but UDI is one of them. So we haven't seen that happen yet because I think people are still building to the 2015 edition rule, but I think that will have a lot of good implications for UDI in the healthcare system and sharing data and being able to track devices. There's something we include in our draft legislation right now, which is requiring certified health information technology to be able to talk to registries. There are a lot of good registries out there that people have spent a lot of time and money, you know, thinking about how we make data useful. Unfortunately, a lot of systems don't talk to registries, so we just decided, well, maybe you guys should talk to each other, right? I think the implications of that long-term for UDI and many other things are very, very big. I think there's a lot of ways we can track information using the systems we have in place right now that just aren't being tapped. In terms of putting it in claims, I know there are a lot of organizations that are very concerned about this. It's not my committee's jurisdiction to say what CMS should or shouldn't do. I do know that CMS sent a letter last year saying that they do not want UDI in claims, that it would be too costly. And, you know, my thought is if it's going to be in EHRs, maybe we see how that plays out and use it before we mandate it on CMS too. You know, I would point out 2 days ago the Congressional Budget Office announced that the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund for Medicare will be depleted in 10 years. So putting new requirements on Medicare at a time when we should probably be thinking about, you know, making sure Medicare lasts for, you know, some of the younger folks and the audience who pay into it and want health care when we're 65, assuming we're still here.
You know. Any other comments, Mike or Alice? Or?
Well, I would just say, you know, in terms of balancing, we've had a lot of discussions on the privacy side and on HIPAA, what we can or can't do, and there just hasn't been a robust discussion on cybersecurity. So I think the time is ripe to really delve into that and do an interagency discussion. Well, it's not interagency, but it's the agencies within HHS, along with DOD and the VA, to figure out what are best practices, what we should look at doing. And, you know, I think we need that conversation right now.
I think we're going to have one final question here because we're at the end of the hour.
Thank you very much. My question, I think it's...
We'll do you and you. We'll do two questions at once, okay?
No, you go ahead. You're first. You're first. Yeah.
My question is, I think, primarily for Alice and Mike. And there's sort of a middle segment between, it seems to me, between the provider and the patient, which is the sort of clerical staff, for want of a better word, that works in practices and in hospitals, who do a lot of this and who are using the software. Mm-hmm. And so my question to each of you is, as you've rolled out different things, have you found that a skilled labor force in which to take the jobs that you're essentially creating, and what role increased role do you see for high schools and community colleges to produce the workers that employ it? And since you have a member of the Hill here, how do you see that playing out? Because I listen and I think it's great stuff, but where are you getting the people? Are they there trained in order to sort of make that bridge?
Excellent question. If you hold that question, give it to this gentleman, and we'll try to do two questions at once, okay?
Okay. Stanley Campbell from Eagle Force Associates. The first comment, as we move from fee-for-service models to pay-for performance, it's virtually impossible, based on that larger shift in risk, to not engage the patient. And so we've got to engage the patient. That being said, the security aspects of meaningful use 1, 2, and 3, the interoperability, information sharing, and with full disclosure, we're partners with Kathleen Robinson with in the federal group at Intel. So I got to kind of push that out there first. And in that environment, we actually have a certified system with NATO, where the 28 nations of NATO have to come into a common operating environment where the United States military comes in with its ALTA system. Germany might come in with Siemens. England might come in with parts of McKesson and the like, because all of those nations of the 28 plus Australia have national systems, which are commercial products primarily. And so with that, on the security side, to the earlier question, those systems are at the U.S. secret, certified at DISA, the Defense Information Services. So, and the NATO has a standardization agreement, NATO STANAG 2517. So the rules are there, the regulations are there, the governance is there. It is primarily U.S.-led because the U.S. funded it for the most part. We don't necessarily have to go to Denmark, who is a partner. to get best practices which are already up and running. So with that as a question, how can we get the, basically we've got industry as a biggest player, we've got the technology folks, because in that, as a Navy pilot, when I get knocked down and I fall in a French cache, they actually can see my electronic medical record from DOD. Mm-hmm. And then when they treat me, it's no longer my dog tag getting pushed back. They can actually send my records back. So when I get back to the U.S. side, they can actually see what the French doc did to me. So with that being said, the sensors, the governance, the policy, I think we got it all right there. We should be able to do this.
So that's the question.
Thank you. Let's take the clerical question first. And yeah. Training question. Yeah, sorry.
So, So
we have a whole set of businesses in the Optum side, from a big pharmacy business to large consulting businesses to analytics businesses to businesses that do nursing care, as I mentioned before. But we also have a lot of direct providers, and we have been able to staff them well. Now, one of the things we've been really trying to push very hard is a set of automation tools and support tools for them, and the support tools around computer-aided coding and other things that make a big difference in terms of being able to stretch the capability of those folks. But at this time, we are able to find people. Having said that, of course, we'd agree that at our experience, we're doing a lot of, especially in the technical area, we're hiring more and more college graduates to see them be better prepared for college, to also see stronger performance in the skills that we need out of high schools, of course, would be very beneficial to our business.
And I would say we definitely need better skilled workforce. We're at a deficit from Intel's point of view, not only at the PhD doctoral, but also at the two-year college level. We could do so much more if we had, you know, a better educated workforce. But I just want to give you this example. While my mother was in the hospital, I was talking to the nurses, and we talked about the electronic health record, and she said, well, I'd like to be doing work at the hospital across town, but they have a different EHR, and I don't know how that works. And it's too much of an uphill climb for me to go over there and figure that out. And that just drove home this interoperability standards issue. And I'd like to address your question based on that. There's a lot of chatter about, you know, well, we don't want to get tied down with yesterday's technology and any kind of legislation. At Intel, we're all about standards. That's why we have a chip that works in multiple PCs. We have servers that work all over the world. It's because of copy exact. Have a standard, agree to it, and move on. And I think it's been really hard for this community to swallow that tough pill. And until we did, it sounds like NATO has figured that out. Until we do, until we have reference implementation models that the industry can decide on, whether it's, you know, government regulations or industry agreements, it's not going to happen. And there's so much thought about, well, you know, you can't innovate if you have to do the same thing. Well, that is just the opposite. You have to get the reference implementation. You have to get those data elements standard. Then you can innovate all over the place. But if you're stuck every time a developer wants to do something different and you have to integrate with, you know, 150 EHRs like we did, then why not go to banking where it's so much easier? We're losing that talent because it is so difficult to do a standard and to operate off of a standard in healthcare. And that would be my final word.
Wonderful. I would like to thank our wonderful panel and our wonderful audience. I know there's just a lot of expertise in the audience as well as on the panel. Thank you very much.